As was just mentioned, a new class starts tonight for all of our folks who are raising youngsters right now. It's in 126. Some of you got to go to that series when it was being done with the teens. And this is for those who are just younger than that, so be aware of that. And then, of course, we, besides having the weather concerns, we do have some of our families who've been dealing with an illness of some sort, a bug of some sort. So help us, please, to check on people so we know if there are folks who need assistance and who need special care. And if you'll let us know about that, it'd be much appreciated so we can kind of keep up that way. If anyone needs a pen or a pencil, I have them here. If anybody does, I have put a good bit more material on this outline than we'll be able to discuss in the class tonight. And I did it partly knowing, having seen the weather today, that some of our folks would not be able to be here. And so there are things on this outline, passages of Scripture that are quite important. I wish we had time to do all of them, but they're there for the benefit of your reading them as if you do some studying on your own during the week. Hope it's going okay for you. We all have our plate full right now, so please remember everyone in your prayers each day. We started a series here with three studies on a view of redemption, and we embarked on the part of this which involves sort of tracing the lines of the biblical story or the lines of biblical history that have to do with the how God's work to bring man back to himself and to be able to live with man. How he works to restore what was ruined in the first three chapters of Genesis. So then we got interrupted with 1 week off, and it seems like ages ago now. But if you remember, we started with the promise. We've suggested that God's promise to Abraham sets the story of Scripture from then on. And God promised to give him a land, to make a great nation out of him, to make his name great, and to bless those who bless him, and to curse those who curse him, and then to bless all the nations of the earth through him. And that, those four great promises, we would like to take the time now for these next 4 weeks to try to go back and trace through. And we want to start with the land promise. The land promise has something about it which fascinates the imagination of people. And if you'll think about it for a minute, you'll be able to see how much this idea grabs people's thought processes. If you are aware of this, the evangelical part of Christendom largely takes a political view that the political nation of Israel right now has a foundation in biblical promise and prophecy which has to be respected in American politics. And without arguing that point with you, I simply want to point out to you that what people assume about the land promise has a bearing on how people believe the world should work right now. That's part of it. Another part of it is that has to do with this being still in effect is that also a large segment of Christendom holds to the idea that biblical prophecy still teaches that in the years immediately before the return of Jesus to establish an earthly kingdom, it is held, people of Israel will be gathered back to the biblical land or the promised land. Often it's associated with the great battle of Armageddon in people's thoughts that surround this. That also relates to what we make of the land promise. There's another part of it that I confess fascinates me. I'm forgetting up here to bring you along to where we are. I'm not dogmatic about this, but it's this part of it. This is in my thinking, in my study. I want you to understand what I'm saying here. It seems to me the more I try to dig into how these promises unfold, that in each of them there is an aspect of a shadow of a type. What God will do to bring people back to Himself kind of cast its shadow back over the entire scope of biblical history. And if I think in my mind about this, I can see how it is possible that you look at what happens in Genesis 3 with sin and with alienation from God and hiding from His presence, and then the consequences, results of that and human experience, and then the being cast out of the garden so that man doesn't live forever in that state of alienation and misery and frustration and pain and so forth that you see there, then I can see how it's possible that in the land promise there is the beginning of when you're learning to write, you trace the letters. When you're learning to read, you read the story in big print and so forth. That there could be the beginning of reinstilling in human imagination how God would work to have a place where He could be back living with those He's made in His image. How He would restore. How maybe this is the elementary part of our education process where we can begin to see what it will mean for us to be included in the household of God and to be in His presence. You know, I used to read about the ways of understanding the God's dealings with mankind, the patriarchal age, the Mosaical age, and the gospel age, or the Christian age. And one way they used to teach us about this is to say, here is the starlight age, here is the moonlight age, and here is the sunlight age. You start out with this faint grasp of things, it gets slightly brighter, and then it gets clearer what God does for us. So I want to at least ask you to start with that possibility in your imagination, that we're dealing with something here other than just God having to have a place to act within history, that He's trying to show us something even farther than that. And that's kind of the way we'll go about this. Now, in your thinking about the land promise, have you done enough consideration of it to think of other ways in which this part of the promise is important to the scheme of redemption? Have you reflected on it enough to think of anything more than just, well, this is where God decided to do it? Can you think of other reasons why it's important? I think of at least one. that God wants to show us that this happens in the real world of human experience. Christianity is different in that it can put names and places to what God does to try to make it possible for us to relate to Him. Luis?
I would say that the whole Bible is, it shows how God is not a tyrant, that He gives us opportunities after opportunity, and we are or so stubborn that sometimes we don't.
All right. May I enlarge on it? Just Louis says the whole Bible shows us that God is not a tyrant. He doesn't simply impose something on us. He gives us choices about it. And I would go just slightly farther and to say also that God is not simply arbitrary. He acts consistently with His will and with who He is, in other words. And He does what He does because that's how things have to be. All right. I thought I would bring a visual tonight. If you think I gave you a bunch of stuff on the paper, I started out to just try to discover for myself in reading the first five books how many times the land is mentioned. This is six. I didn't write the whole verses. I wrote a verse and a line by it so I could remember. So I want you to visualize how important this is to this part of the biblical story. Now, let's start in with it here. First, the land promise is made to Abraham and it develops. We've read parts of these already, so I'm going to depend on you mostly to do this part of the reading on your own. But just to remember, in Ur of the Chaldees, God tells Abram to get up and go to the, it says, go to the land I will show you. So who makes the choice here about the land? Where it is and what land it is, and who makes the choice? God does. And He uses a man who believes Him enough to go to a place that he never even has seen yet. And then who believes in God enough to let God tell him this is the place. And he goes to Canaan. Genesis 12 and verse 5 says when he's come to the land of Canaan. And then God says in verse 7, I will give to you and to your offspring this land. So you have God making a choice, specifying the place, and then making a promise that He would give the land. So this is God's sovereign and gracious choice. Just as sometimes He chose people, in this case Abram, He also chose land, a place. Now, knowing what you know of Bible history and geography, can you think of any reasons why God would have chosen this place if He wanted to bless all the nations of the earth, ultimately? All right, Ruth. It was not only central, if you take the world around the Mediterranean Sea and then the ancient Near East up the Tigris and Euphrates Valley, there would be a road that would come up between those rivers and down from the north. It would pass right straight through this land on the way to Egypt and then North Africa. And where was at least the historical, civilized part of the world at that time? Right there, especially Egypt and the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. So God chooses a place which is bound to come in contact with caravans of people from all areas, east and west, and He uses it in that way. We come to Genesis 15. And notice up here the words in red, they go on the blanks on your paper. And I want you to see that there is an in and a from and a to here. In Genesis 15, God enters into the covenant with Abraham, and he tells him, "Know for certain that your offspring or your seed, your descendants, will be sojourners." What's a sojourner? He's a traveler or a pilgrim or a stranger. Sojourners in a land that's not theirs. Now, what's that tell you about Abraham's? If God has already told Abraham, "Abram, I'm going to multiply your offspring, make a great nation out of it. I'm going to give you this land." What's that tell you from the start? They're going to live somewhere else for a while, right? And there'll be servants there, and they'll be afflicted for 400 years. And then he talks about a judgment that he'll bring on the nation that they serve. Turns out to be Egypt. And then in verse 16, they'll come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. And the Amorites turns out to be another word for the Canaanites, or the peoples of that land. And that would tell you also that in giving the people this land, he will also be dealing with the sin of the people who had been there before. In verse 18, on that day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, "To your offspring I give this land from the river of Egypt." That turns out not to be the Nile, but the small brook, or you can find it on your in maps in your Bible at the back. Probably you'll notice the little river at the south, right between Egypt and what we think of the Promised Land, to the great river, the River Euphrates. So you're dealing with the north part of the River Euphrates, the southern one of the Tigris and Euphrates, really. And then it mentions the nations who live there. So God has promised to give a land. He has also set a time for it, fourth generation from the patriarchs, and he's specified the borders of it. It's a pretty specific promise. The people, the time, the place, all there. Genesis 17 and verse 8. He mentions here that he's going to give to Abram and to his offspring the land of his sojournings. That would say that Abram is never going to be able to sit down and live in a house. He'll be traveling through the promised land throughout his life. And all the land of Canaan for an everlasting possession. Now that becomes an important phrase, everlasting possession. What will that mean as the story of Scripture goes along? To us, we hear it like it means eternal. I'm told the Hebrew term can mean the whole age, or age long, that idea possibly even. And notice this, "And I will be their God." Now there brings another part of this that's important. That anticipates a land where there will be a people where God will be in relation to that people. And so the question will come, well, all right, then how will he deal with the fact that he's still dealing with people who are fallen people and who have sin to deal with? How will God be able to how long will he be able to live with them? And how will this holy God live with people who've had to run and hide from his presence from back in Genesis 3? That'll become an important part of the story. And please, I've put a note that I ask you to consider on your paper that I think is important. Always, it seems, in these promises, as they are re-enumerated through the story in Genesis, it seems that they're always mentioned in connection with some spiritual part of this, like there being the people of God, and with the offspring part of it. In other words, it's never simply the land that issue. It's going to be the people and how God relates to these people, how they relate to Him. These don't appear in isolation with each other. Now, there are other cases where these promises come up. For now, I'm going to leave it there. This is the way it develops with Abraham. Now, from this point on, the touchstones that we will need to consider are going to be here in this. We already know what land, we already know relatively when, and also a bit about the intended purpose of this. So now the land promise passes down. It passes down first to Isaac. I put this again before you. God tells Isaac, do not go down to Egypt. You sojourn in this land. I'm going to give this land to you and to your offspring. And in doing it, I'm going to fulfill my oath that I swore to Abraham, your father. So first to Isaac, then to Jacob. Please notice these passages here on your paper with Jacob. First, what he calls later on Bethel in Genesis 28. And this is a place he went to sleep. You remember what he saw that night when he slept? A ladder with, remember, the angels ascending and descending. Remember? And God told him, I'm going to give this land you're lying on to you and to your offspring. So that, and that's, he was leaving to go to Laban's when that promise was given. Try to get away from Esau. In chapter 35, he's coming back. And God meets him again and promises him he's going to give him all this land. And in doing so, he's going to keep the promise that he made to Abraham. This is the time when he changes Jacob's name to Israel. And again, the land promise is there. In Genesis 46, this is after Joseph has been away from him in Egypt, and his sons have tried to go down there and buy food, and they've ended up being taken in by Joseph, and Joseph wants them to bring their father down there, you remember? And what happens is that God appears to Jacob and says, I'm the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for there I'll make you into a great nation. And I myself will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also bring you up again. Now, that would say that the covenant God, covenant-making God, is not limited to the place that he's going to give to the people, right? The fact that God was going to give that land to Abram and his offspring did not mean that God was going to live in that land and only be there, did it? He could go with Israel down into Egypt. And then in chapter 48, Jacob explains this to Joseph, and he in Egypt, and he tells Joseph what God has said to him and that God has promised to give the land to them for an everlasting possession. So now then, notice, please, that this promise gets restated at these important junctures to Isaac, and then Jacob when he's leaving, Jacob when he's coming back, Jacob when he's going down to Egypt, and then in these last two passages here, to Joseph, or by Joseph. Joseph, what before Joseph died, what requirement did he ask of his countrymen? All right, for his bones to be. How did Joseph know that his people were going to be leaving Egypt someday? How did he know? All right, his father told him. What? How did his father know? God told him. So what's happening is a promise is impacting a family's understanding of who they are and also their actions with regard to the future that they expect. I take it that what God wanted to happen is for His promises to become so important in the lives of His people that they would impact the people's understanding of who they were and their expectations of what their future would be. So by the time we get to the end of Genesis, God has made that much progress in His project. He at least has a family who takes His promises so much to heart that they understand themselves in light of them and they make their plans for the future with regard to God's promises. That's a huge... How did people go wrong in the garden in Genesis 3? They doubted what God said. They were willing to believe the tempter. Remember what he said? Yes, has what? Has God said? So we get to the end of this. Don't miss this now. You have Joseph making plans about his own bones because God said. Now that's much more important than maybe we realize. All right, move along here and notice now that this gets made to Moses and Israel. And God at the burning bush tells Moses, "I'm the Lord. I've seen what's happening to my people. I've come down to deliver them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land." Notice now, to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey. To the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. What strikes you about that statement? At least two things. This is where the Amorites live. They're, to Abraham, he said, their iniquity is not yet full. I take it, it's about that way here. And what's the description of the land, the promised land that appears here for the first time? A land flowing with milk and honey. What does that mean? Everything you need. It's a rich. It has blessings. There'll be many rewards of living in this place. And this gets repeated. Look over in chapter 6 in verse 8. This is what Moses is to tell the people. "I will bring you into the land that I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, and I'll give it to you for a possession. I am the Lord." At this point, what reason do these people have to think that they will possess that land? What are they at this moment? They're slaves. They've been that way a long time. At this moment, what reason do they have to think they'll ever possess a land flowing with milk and honey? God said. Bottom line, I am the Lord. I'm the living God. I can say what I want to do, and then I can do it. And you can count on me to be trustworthy and faithful, which Adam and Eve in the beginning were not. Now, we go along. I'll point out to you here in Exodus 6, a thing that's interesting to me. If you count up, in verses 16 through 20, you have, and think about this, after Jacob, you have Levi, and then in this family we're interested in, then he becomes the father of Kohath, who becomes the father of Amram, who becomes the father of Moses and Aaron. How many generations? In which generation did God say he would bring them out? Fourth. Genesis 15. That's where we are here. And that way. And then in chapter 23 of Exodus, it turns out, verse 31, God brings them out to Mount Sinai, and they enter into a covenant with him here. And among the first things that God says to them is that he's going to bring them into the land little by little, so that they won't be overwhelmed in the process. And he says in verse 31, I will set your border from the Red Sea, that was where the river of Egypt flowed there, and the Sea of the Philistines, that'd be the Mediterranean, to the wilderness, that would be west of the Jordan, to the Euphrates, the great river, and I'll give the inhabitants of that land into your hand. That's exactly the borders that Genesis 15 and verse 18 set. The time, the place, and the people are all involved at this point here. Now, so we got like 15 minutes to do to survey here. So please use your imagination with me, if you will, and let's explore kind of what happens. Now, on the way here to the promised land, these former slaves become a nation. We'll explore that next time here. But to those people, God sheds light about the land promise, why it was happening, and what they needed to understand about it. Three things that at least are especially important. Number one, this was happening because it was happening for judgment on the iniquity of these nations. This is really important. Leviticus 18 would be a place to look. I'm going to, let me see which one of these here. Let me read two verses from Leviticus 18. He says to the people, do not make yourselves unclean by any of these things. And back up, what does he mean by that? Look up verse 21 of Exodus, of Leviticus 18. You shall not give any of your children to offer them to Molech. Who is Molech? One of the Canaanite gods, fertility gods of some sort. They were offering their children in Canaan, they were offering their children to an idol god. How? Sacrificing them and burning them. The iniquity of the Amorites got full in that way, and God was exercising, in giving the land to Israel, God was also exercising judgment on that kind of behavior. It happens also to, I don't know how I got so far ahead of us here. It happens also for the protection of the people that God was taking for his own as well. He specifies that they're to make sure they do not make any covenant with these people, because it would then serve to ruin them. And there are three passages here. Let me read the one from Deuteronomy 12. So you'll see what I mean by this. What God essentially tells the people along the way is, look, the land is vomiting these people out because of the immorality and evil and ungodliness. If you go there and make yourself an ally of that kind of behavior and act that way too, the land will do to you the same thing it did to the nation before you. So there are people who accuse God of unfairness by throwing out this one, these nations, and putting this one in. But if you understand, God tells them ahead of time, if you act like they did, it'll do the same thing to you. Then you see that there's not injustice intended that way. Deuteronomy 12 now, verses 29 through 31. When the Lord your God cuts off before you the nations whom you go in to dispossess, you dispossess them and dwell in their land, take care that you not be ensnared to follow them after they've been destroyed before you, and that you not inquire about their gods, saying, how did these nations serve their gods, that I also may do the same? You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way, for every abominable thing that the Lord hates, they have done for their gods. For they even burned their sons and their daughters in the fire to their gods. What is there about human nature that makes us want to imitate that which has already led to disaster? But there's something about us which is that way, and that's what God's warning them about here. So it's for their protection that he has all of these people removed. At least that's what he wanted. And then it's also for the enjoyment. He wants his people to enjoy his goodness, to enjoy having a God who keeps his promises, dwelling there with them and among them. And Deuteronomy 11, verse 8, I'm trying to say. It begins a wonderful text about this, and it talks about what God's intentions for them are. Let me read this section for you to think about. You shall therefore keep the whole commandment that I command you today, that you may be strong and go in and take possession of the land that you're going over to possess, and that you may live long in the land that the Lord swore to your fathers to give to them and to their offspring, a land flowing with milk and honey. Now, just reading that, by the way, you'd understand, if you think about it, why God gave them the law that he did. He wants them to be able to function as a people and to live in the land in a way that would be civilized. And for the land that you are entering to take possession of is not like the land of Egypt from which you have come, where you sowed your seed and irrigated it like a garden of vegetables. But the land that you're going over to possess is a land of hills and valleys, which drinks water by the rain from heaven, a land that the Lord your God cares for. The eyes of the Lord your God are always upon it, from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. Now, that means it would be certainly different from the barren desert areas, but the thing that is to be understood from it is that it's not simply the natural lie of the land so much as the fact that God, who keeps his covenant, would be watching over them ideally and blessing them in that way. All right, I'm going to have to hurry now. Notice one thing from this. They're continuing to live in the land that they're about to receive is going to be on condition of covenant loyalty. And this is said so many times in Deuteronomy. It's what the whole book of Deuteronomy is about. And I'll say it this way. The reception of the land for these people was unconditional. God had promised it to Abraham and God was going to fulfill his promises. But what about their continuing in the land? It was conditional upon their willingness to live there with him, to hear his word, to respect his covenant, to obey his will. His promise to Abraham was not conditional because Abraham responded by faith. His promise to these people is conditional. Let me read the passage from Deuteronomy 5, verse 31. And this is repeated in spirit for the rest of this book. But you stand here by me, this Moses, to the people, and I'll tell you the whole commandment and the statutes and the rules that you shall teach them, that they may do them in the land that I am giving them to possess. You shall be careful, therefore, to do as the Lord your God has commanded you. You shall not turn aside to the right hand or to the left. You shall walk in all the way that the Lord your God has commanded you, that you may live and that it may go well with you and that you may live long in the land that you shall possess. Implied is, what if you don't? Just reading that, what would you say would happen if they don't listen to God and walk in his ways and obey his commandment? Pardon?
Consequences are doing the contrary.
With regard to the land, though, what? You know, that's right. You're not going to be there long. You're not going to be able to continue there. You can't receive a gift by covenant and then keep it by rejecting covenant. And that's what happens here. Now, 5 minutes. I want to try to let you see this overall picture here before tonight. Now, the land is therefore entered with covenant stipulations. In Deuteronomy 28, you can read in these passages here, if you obey my will, if you keep the commandment, if you walk in my ways, what he'll do for them. But there's an if not. And the if not is that there will be, if you break your agreement with me, there will be a scattering from this land. Read especially, underline on your paper, the Deuteronomy 28 and verses 64 and 65, and it specifies that the land would spit them out. And even in spite of that, in Deuteronomy 30, God says, when you're cast out and you're a captive in the land of one of the nations, if you over there will remember my law and turn your heart back to me, then because of my covenant that I made with Abraham, I'll bring you back. What an astonishing... But one thing about Deuteronomy 30, you got to bear in mind, this happens after the curse of the covenant has fallen on them, while they're in a land where they're captives, when they turn their heart and keep his law. Again, if you're really thinking, in the New Testament you read that that law has been taken out of the way. By what event? The cross of Christ. And that it therefore, these sacrifices and so forth are no more. Then you recognize that Deuteronomy 30 cannot possibly be talking about something that would happen after the death and resurrection of Christ. And that would have some bearing on things now. So what happens then? The prophets, in the meantime, interpret events in history as they're going on, and they will say that only when people go captive, away captive, they're going to come back after 70 years, but only a remnant will come back. A remnant is to a people what the 5-minute bell is to a class. It means only a little bit. A remnant, only a little bit. Jeremiah uses the picture of an earthen vessel, which is broken in pieces, and then a part of it is gathered back, not the whole thing. So then, I'll summarize it this way, so you'll know what I meant here. All the land promised is possessed by the people. These four passages are quite important to the Old Testament. Joshua, in the days of Joshua, he'll say, all the land, it mentions the landmarks that we've read about, the river of Egypt, the great river, the sea, the wilderness, all of it. God, you have kept your... God has done what He's promised. He's given the whole land. In 1 Kings 4:21, Solomon rules over the whole land from the border of Egypt to the great river. At this point, how much of the land promise remained to be fulfilled? You know what I'm getting at. Say it. None. If God gave all of it, if He fulfilled His whole promise, if the people ruled over the whole thing, then that's at least where it started out. Now, what about Him being their God? What about their being His people? We'll get to it next time. There's where the problem comes in. The faithless people, by faithless I mean they are untrustworthy, they do not keep the covenant. Remember when Solomon rules over the whole thing, what happens in the latter part of Solomon's life? All right. He starts building temples to foreign gods, to idols and so forth, and he's unfaithful. And when Solomon dies, what happens? The kingdom is split. 1 Kings 11 specifies that was God's judgment. Why did he keep the southern kingdom for Rehoboam? Because of his promises to David. And then in 2 Kings 17, the northern kingdom, boy, it's a sad chapter. You ought to read 2 Kings 17. They get carried away, and that's the end of them. That leaves the southern kingdom, but acting the same way, and after another 120 years or so, they're carried away captive, and only the ruins are left. This gets explained to the people by Jeremiah. It'll be 70 years. The people over there, I know this verse, by the way, Jeremiah 29:11, I know the plans I have for you. That's a warm, fuzzy verse, but just remember, it was said to people who were carried away captive. God meant for that experience and captivity to refine them, to make them repent, to turn their hearts back to His law. And He'd bring the ones of them that wanted to come and would come back from captivity, which He did. The remnant returns. And it's said in how many books? 1, 2, 3, 4 of the Old Testament books. And you got to remember, the prophets are talking, are preaching and doing their writing prior to this. Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi are the last ones. But they're more at the same time as Ezra than they are of any of the others. So what the prophets are talking about would be understood as explaining what God was doing to the land and why and what the return meant. And then the New Testament suggests the real goal of these land promises. I got to end with this. And if the bell gets us, just stay with me just a second. Hebrews 11. Okay. about Abraham. By faith, he went to live in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. He shows he's looking forward to that by going where God tells him to go. Verse 13, these all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For people who speak thus make it clear that they're seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country. That is, what kind? A heavenly one. One from heaven. That is, therefore God's not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. And then I get over here to the end of the Bible, Revelation 21, at verse 3. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling place of God, the tabernacle of God, some versions say, is with man. He will dwell with them, and they'll be his people, and God will be with them as their God. Where is the promised land? Where does it find its fulfillment? I think it does in Revelation 21 and 3. That's my opinion. You do some studying and thinking about it yourself. Man, thank you guys for being with us on a kind of a foggy night.